Welcome back, WNST, Taos in Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. We're at Fadley's. It is segment three, and it's getting spicy around here. We need to take a little break, and I mean, we promised you down for like conversation and crab cakes. We've been okay on the conversation, Governor Martin O'Malley, but the crab cakes, you know, this is what we got to do here. We're going to get into this. There it is. You were once mayor. Fadley's. You used to do all this.
I'm going
to
guess the mayor is
always promoting local business.
I bet. My guess is the mayor's been here once or twice.
Yeah, I have a feeling this is not your first crab cake.
Law school right over there. So this was the lunchroom every day during law school. The days I went.
We're having so much fun in this conversation. Usually, you know, I try to dominate and run in and tell stories and make people laugh. I've got a word in edgewise, and I wrote down a few things that I want to get to.
Okay.
We want to talk about
you
the
go bed. Ahead.
We're going to do smarter government. We talked about.
I'm going to eat. You go ahead.
This is good. You eat. That's perfect. You eat the crab cake. We'll talk about the government. The situation with crisis management and what you went through with the fire under the city and any God knows what could have gone wrong the years you were governor. The mayor here went through a crisis over Northwest Baltimore back in the summer 2000 or spring of 2015 that the words Freddie Gray and riot and unrest and buildings on fire, all the things that we saw, and we're still dealing with that 4 years later. We now have another mayor indicted. Lord knows what's going to happen there. Run me back to that day for you, and I don't want to say if you were mayor, but I mean if you were mayor, I mean that's a fair enough question because I think moves were made on that day in crisis management that I'm still paying for as a taxpaying citizen downtown, the perception of our city, what the fiasco that became and the aftermath. I looked out the window. I live on at the top of Harbor Court, and I saw the city on fire. I saw the building in the northeast. I saw that building burning. It was, I'll show you the picture of what I saw, and you'd say, oh, my God, because it was a fireball in the sky that lasted until they could get it out.
That was the big church in East Baltimore?
The big church in East Baltimore,
which
correct.
Had nothing to do with the riot?
Fair enough. But it
except
was on,
coincidentally.
Coincidentally. But it was on fire
and
while my television was
and
on fire.
And CNN never stopped filming it because
right.
it was the biggest fire.
Right. Keep showing it.
But it had nothing to do with the riot.
It's what I saw out my window.
Right.
Okay. So I turned to my wife. I said, my God, we might never be the same again with this going on. The reputation of bringing business, keeping business. I was at your friend's place where you play up on Charles Street, and there was a lot of damage up and down Charles Street.
Right.
What happened in the aftermath? Run me through what's supposed to happen there or what could have or might have happened to make sure we didn't have that situation.
Oh, golly. Could have, should have, would have. I think the biggest, let's take a deep breath here.
Sure.
And let's remember that we are not the first city to have a riot. We are not the only city that wrestles with the American problem of law enforcement being intertwined with racial injustice since our country's founding. We're not the first city to have corrupt mayors, albeit we've had a couple in short order. Other cities have gone through traumas like those, but nonetheless get back on the horse and figure out how to make their cities more safe, more livable, better places, learn from the lessons, and do better moving forward. And that's what we need to do. In terms of lessons to learn in hindsight, the after action, if you will.
Sure.
Right.
One of the biggest mistakes that still to this day is underreported and not much understood except in our poor neighborhoods is that Baltimore kind of stopped policing its police during the BATS years, stopped doing the integrity stings, stopped publishing the discourtesy excessive force. On the day of the Freddie Gray riot, half of the appointed, I think, 9 or 10 members of the Civilian Review Board had been vacant positions for 8 months. They were down to one detective. He was told he couldn't even go outside of the office. The backlog was huge. The complaints from the public at community forums were rising.
I bet morale was down, too.
Morale was down, and yet... you know, we had stopped policing the police. I believe that is the most important lesson. When I met with those folks that did the DOJ report, although they didn't have the guts to sign their name to the report, I met with them. And I said, well, I assume you're going to be recommending that we do take all of these steps to police the police. Are you also going to put in your report that we used to do them but stopped?
Right.
And they all kind of looked at each other and said... why do you think they stopped? And I said, because that stuff's hard. and there was a recession, and budgets needed to be cut, and nobody noticed when they stopped doing the things to police the police. And so until this happened, I said, I hope you're going to say that. And they said, well, yeah. You know,
well, they never did. Narrative, right? Doesn't fit.
It didn't fit. They had already decided that you know that they had a reason for the riot, and that was because of excessive, brutal, racist policing that no doubt had to have started under the last white mayor. So that was their narrative. That's what they stuck with. That's what they did. And as a result, we haven't really learned a lot from the about the fact that we stopped policing the police and the impact that had. But on an operational level, there were a few things that I think, in hindsight, we know we should never. Ever do again. One is to cut off bus service to a school that we know is being hammered, and we still to this day don't know who was hammering Douglas with those messages that there's going to be a riot after school. That was something that required some capacity of signals intelligence that would indicate that it was not merely a private sector force.
Well, you talked about cyber earlier. In 2001, you didn't have to worry about a bunch of kids sending text messages to get together, right? Like, we're in a different world.
Yeah, you did during Freddie Gray.
And that was happening. That was happening then, but they were also someone with a technology and cyber capacity had ring-fenced that area of Douglas and was bombarding the kids there with messages that there was going to be, an action, a riot after school. To this day, I don't think we know who it was, but it wasn't the only place where that happened. I talked to Secretary of Education Arne Duncan that next day, and he started asking specific questions about whether the place had been ring-fenced in those matches. I said, yeah, and he said, that's happening in other places
as well. We certainly had some of that, Governor. You'll remember, because of the government cooperation, some of that was actually spreading at that time to Baltimore County. Hmm. Same kind of things, where Candace was, oh, my God, it's happening at Douglas. Now the copycats would pick up, and you had that kind of
How much is copycat?
Fear.
How much is intentional, a bad actor? But here's the big mistake we made. Somebody said, well, if this is going to happen after Douglas, we better cut down bus service to Douglas. Stop it. So somebody at the city called somebody at the state, probably without checking with the mayor of the city or the governor of the state. Perhaps they did. I don't know.
Right.
And said, cut off bus service. So when the kids were released after school, they had no place to go.
They were just there.
They were all milling about.
Right.
And across the street, oh, by the way, we had arrayed mostly white police officers from Montgomery County in riot gear to stand in front of the shopping mall. We did everything but, flip a coin to see which side would kick off and hand out rocks. So that was a huge mistake. Had I been mayor or governor, I might have counter-suggested that a better approach would be to call Ubers for everybody,
get them home,
do a
quick
phased release, and give them mints and water on the way home, too. That would have been a better way to handle it, but that didn't happen. And so this powder keg erupted with the cascading and other effects. But the anger with police and the distrust of police was very real, but we had contributed to that. Well, I say we, meaning we, the people through our government, had contributed to that by ending the regimen of actions that we used to have in place to police the police.
And Nestor, I think you asked that when Matt Gallagher was here. And again, for those of you listening, we're with Governor and Mayor Martin O'Malley, written a terrific book called A Smarter Government. We're going to talk about the Chesapeake Bay in a minute. But when Matt was here, Matt was walking us through a number of things you had done with State Stat and City Stat. And Nestor, I remember pretty specifically, you said to Matt, as a citizen, you said, I don't understand. This was all in place. We were holding people accountable.
Yeah.
We had dots on a map. We were having these meetings. We were drilling down to those questions, the sanitation question that you talked about two segments ago when you talked about absenteeism. So Nestor's going, I'm a citizen, Matt. What the hell happened?
I've had my place up for sale for a year and a half. I can't give it away, right? I mean, I haven't had anybody walk through it. I live in the most beautiful part of the city. I'm mad as hell about all of this. This is my life's investment. It's the reason
I do
all
the positive. That's why we're doing this, trying to turn the narrative.
And part of this is action as well. I sat and watched the city on fire, and I know you'll dispute that, but from my vantage point at that moment, and my wife had just survived leukemia the first time. She was about to have a second about 5 months later. And I looked out the window, and you know what I did, Governor, next day? I got back on the radio with my 100,000 listeners and my big brand and all that. I talked about the Orioles, and I talked about the Capitals, and I talked about the draft, the NFL. Life is normal. You know, I acted like it didn't happen because I'm like, that's black, that's white, that's West, that's
messy.
Police, that's messy, that's government. I don't want to piss anybody off. I might be wrong. I don't want to be the loud Howard Beale screaming out of my window about something I have no idea about, policing and race and perception and trust and what's going on. And I dummied up. And my wife had cancer and battled again and watching her battle. And about a year and a half ago, he's running the county. And I called him and I said, you know what? I'm going to come out of the closet on this, where I am, on keeping my mouth shut. Because it has not benefited me as a citizen. It has not benefited me as a business owner. It does not benefit me when I walk down Charles Street and see Reggie's is no longer there. Right. You know, and businesses aren't there. And we come here to Lexington Market and we see that all of it could be better. So that's the reason you're here right now, because I was inspired to say, I'm not going to look out the window and just talk about baseball anymore.
Yeah, good. You know, I don't think any of us can go silent. To the extent we're resilient and realize that life goes on, that's good. But we also all have to summon up the courage to talk honestly about our problems and the things that solve those problems.
We can't accept this.
I've written op-eds to the Sun about the things we used to do, the things that we need to start doing again in order to police the police, and also, I mean, get this: how often do we ever hear people talking about the fact that we've cut the size of our police force by a third?
Right, or 400 vacancies, right?
More than that. I think when in that final year, which would have been Mayor Sheila Dixon's final year in office, of that 10-year stretch where we led the nation in reducing crime, I think our sworn force was about 3,150.
Now we're down 2,600.
We're about 2,500, mm-hmm. But get this, and now 300 of them can't testify.
Right.
So that you're not a very effective police officer if you can't testify, because if you can't testify, you can't arrest.
So
we need to speak honestly about our problems, and I hope that people will read chapters 4 and 5 in this book. I've been there was a guy named Alec McGillis who wrote a piece for the New York Times that was an honest rendition of the facts of our history and our case. But there's been, and maybe in the course of this mayor's race, we'll have a more honest discussion about the things that need to be done. But we can't just simply think that we can say what's fashionable and that'll save lives. And
Governor, I want to pick up on that, and I'm interrupting you because you get me so fired up when you talk about these things. Why is it, it's troubled me for years, why is it so difficult, or how do we address it? Because the why problems are sometimes difficult. Why is it so difficult for the FOP? Nestor's spilling on the book.
I'm not.
It was 23 years to write.
Why is it, when I hear you talk and others, and certainly what I believed as county executive, we call it constitutional policing, policing the police, you can believe that and be 100% supportive of law enforcement. It seems to me these silos are like, oh, if you believe that, you hate cops. No, we don't hate cops. We believe there's a right way for cops. We have the utmost respect for people who put their lives on every day. Why is it so difficult for the FOP to come to the table and have a real discussion on that issue? You've experienced it. Why is that a problem for them?
I think we live in a more polarized time now, perhaps in some ways, but not that much more polarized.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there were.
Well, what was your relationship with the FOP? Let's go back to that.
They did not endorse me for mayor, nor did they endorse me in either of my races for governor, even though I was ahead of my opponent, and even though I had given them the largest raise in Baltimore history over a three-year period of 7%, 8%, 9%. When I went to the FOP headquarters after I was elected mayor, and I laid out what our plan was moving forward, I acknowledged the fact that we were on opposite sides of the election. I told them that I was nonetheless, because it's in the best interest of the city, going to be pushing for a big raise in order to bring our salaries, make our salaries competitive. And I said, and what I need to also inform you of is that I promised we were going to do a better job of policing the police. That's what we need to do. And we need to do it not only for the good of our citizens, we need to do it for your own
that
personal
makes them
safety.
Safer.
We need to do it for your own personal
yes.
safety, because before the gun, the badge, the car, or the radio, the what's going to save your lives is the trust of the people you serve in every single neighborhood of our city. And you know who else we're going to do it for? And there was a whole row of the line of duty widows sitting in the front row. I remember John Platt's wife there, and I said, we're going to do it for her, and for her, and for her, and for her, and for her. And I said, and I need you men and women to be with me on this. There's no reason why your good work should be tarnished by the bad actions of a few bad apples. And that's what we did. And you know what? We had conversations. They had their perspective done. I'm not saying that they ever stopped being a labor organization. They have their politics, too. You know, they have to run for election. But I think we could get there again.
You're hopeful.
I'm hopeful. I choose to be hopeful. But it needs leadership. One of the things, somebody said, what did you understand after you wrote the book that you didn't know before you wrote it? And I said, well, let me answer that question a different way. What I understood after, you know, with the benefit of hindsight and reflection, what I've come to understand that I misunderstood when I was running for mayor is it's not 90% policy and 10% leadership and follow through. It's 90% leadership and follow through and 10% policy.
Well, let's pick up on that and let's do something real positive, because you're so proud. You took city state to the state. You made it state stat. You expanded this whole idea of GIS dots on a map to all kinds of governmental operations. Probably one of the ones that I would guess you're the most proud of is the success at cleaning up the Chesapeake Bay.
Yeah, someone asked me, what makes you happiest that you spent those years in public service? I said the lives saved in Baltimore and turning around the health of the Chesapeake Bay. Yeah.
So walk us through the bay. I can imagine bringing people
pages
together.
Pages 212 and 213. I'm just going to hold it up.
Yeah, so
this explain those maps, Governor.
Okay, so this is a map. Red is dead. Green is life. We have been in Maryland, thanks to the University of Maryland Center for Environmental Science, measuring objectively with scientific indicators the health of the bay according to, you know, six criteria. Water clarity, dissolved oxygen, chlorophyll A, benthic life, biotic life, photoplankton, and subaquatic grasses. Okay, that's seven. I think they mix benthic and biotic.
Man, it's almost like you went to school for this.
Well,
pretty good.
You know, I did, because every month, gathered in the state stat room,
here we go,
would be all of the members of the Bay Cabinet, not just the Secretary of Environment, but the Secretary of Natural Resources, the Secretary of Transportation. Why? Because who owns the greatest amount of paved surface in the state of Maryland that we now know takes rainwater runoff and hardwires it like poison into the veins of the bay? It's the State Department of Transportation. Highways, right?
Sure.
Most of them built before in the 1970s,
right,
when we didn't know that that had such a damaging impact on the health
of
the streams.
Not to mention the salt we were dumping on it, right?
Right. Which also runs off along with the, you know, exhaust and everything else. Corrections was there. When Gary Maynard from Corrections said, I want to start coming to Bay Cabinets, I said, why, Gary? Do you fish? He said, no, we have a whole program we're embarking on to reduce recidivism, that is, people returning to prison, and reduce the incarceration rate in our state, and it's all around restorative justice, getting our men and women engaged in work that gives back to the greater common good we share. And I think that bay restoration, gleaning farmers' fields for food for the Maryland Food Bank, helping with oyster replenishment will help us drive down our recidivism rate. And he was right. So he was there at the table. Also, another important person at that much more collaborative table than simply fixing potholes or the picking up the trash was the University of Maryland Center for Environmental Science, because they understood the science. They understood the engineering.
You're kind of listening to science.
And they were like referees.
It's a revolutionary idea.
It's unbelievable, right? I mean,
they were like the umpire also behind the plate at the baseball game. They'd call the balls and strikes in terms of what was a given action worth, really, in terms of reducing nitrogen or phosphorus or sediment flow into the bay. We'd like to believe that, planting a couple of trees has a huge impact, when the truth is you have to actually plant a million trees to have, you know, so whatever it is.
Sure.
Or what is an acre of cover crop planted in the winter after a season of corn worth in terms of sucking up the excess fertilizer versus what is it worth when you plant it in an acre after soy? So it was all math. We teased out not the 3,600, not the 3,600, but the 36 most impactful actions in terms of things like cover crops or upgrading our wastewater treatment plants or reducing the spread of septic sprawl, that is, housing developments served by septic systems as they're, instead of wastewater treatment. And we started driving, met every month, mapped it, measured it, modeled it, and then soon Virginia started doing as we were doing. Yeah. Not with a 40-year hope, but with a 2-year milestone of actions, measurable actions, to get to the tipping point by 2020 of when our actions on the land would join forces with the restorative power of God's creation to make the each of the 10 rivershed of the bay, which, by the way, stretch over 6 different states, a little healthier every year instead of a little sicker every year, which had been the trend for 300 years. So that's why this map...
What chapter?
This is pages 212 and 213.
212 and 213. Quick story. Our first environmental secretary, Sherry Wilson, this was where we started, by the way. This was the very red and very dead map in 2006. And then this is where we ended with the trends mostly towards a healthier, a much healthier trend throughout the Bay, healthiest being down in the lower stem where things are easier. But Sherry Wilson, when I told her when we were setting 16 strategic goals for the state after our first year in office, I said, Sherry, I need a goal on the Bay. We've had 40-year hopes and governors always claiming they were going to do something. And a lot of them did. I mean, I built on the good work that done by governors ahead of me, Ehrlich, Glenn Denning, Governor Harry Hughes in particular. We need to have a goal, Sherry. She said, please, Governor, don't set a goal on water. I said, why not? She said, what happens if we don't hit it? I said, yeah, but what if we do? She said, yeah, but what if we don't? I said, yeah, but what if we do? She said, yeah, but what if we don't? I said, how long are we going to play this game? Well, we need a goal. And so Sherry and I agreed that we would set the goal of reaching the healthier Bay tipping point by 2020. But, and however, we had 2-year milestones. So the public could see on public-facing dashboards whether we were actually doing the actions that would drive us up that that ramp to a healthier Bay.
Open data again. Transparency.
You're most proud of this. If we said to you, what's the long...
You're proud
tale
of this.
Of your administration, this would be something that 30 years from now you feel like people are going to eat oysters because you did this.
I hate to put a most on it, but I do the lives saved in Baltimore and the Chesapeake Bay are the two things that remind me in my heart when I say to myself sometimes, boy, I might have picked the wrong vocation. Those are the things that tell me that it was work worth doing.
I love, and again, there's so many parts of this book. I mentioned to you during a break, I almost came out of my chair at home when I read the part of the book that talks about beware the culture of excuses. Now, I'm trying to... and just
can
for
I read
folks,
these?
Yeah, read them out, Nestor.
They're the same in every culture,
so
too.
Good.
I want to watch your body language.
They're so good.
These,
now, imagine he's talking about now cleaning up the Chesapeake Bay. Now go to that. That's
right.
The transition.
What we do can't be measured.
Ding, 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 ding.
Can't measure.
That's the bullshit meter. Ding, 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 ding.
We are too busy to have that many meetings.
Ding, 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 ding.
So far.
We don't have the staff to collect all those numbers, Martin.
Ding, ding, ding.
We don't like to make our people uncomfortable in front of others. We're already doing that. We're already cleaning up the Bay. You like that one?
Ding, ding, ding.
We could find out, but it would take months, maybe years. We'd have to pull people off of other work. We don't like to blame or embarrass our people around here. We tried cleaning up the Bay once. It didn't work. That just won't work here.
Here. Yeah.
You that one?
Here's the great flag. Whenever you hear here.
We don't have the time or money to do that here.
Here.
That's not the way we do things.
Here.
It's different.
Here.
All right. So you...
I mean, is this...
Our drug dealers are the smartest in the world.
Here. This, to me, this was it. And I called some of your former staffers when I read this. I said, oh, my Lord, how familiar is this? And what I'm struck by with this, and we are going to do a little politics before we get out of here. Does this... what this says to me, and react to it, that government at its core is about culture. And Nestor always says, what is the way you set? You're either getting better or you're getting worse.
That's it.
You know, it's about, and
that's
these,
Tony
to me,
Robbins
these seem like
forward or back. Right.
These seem like cultural questions to me. Can we change the culture? Is that what governing's about? I mean, you've been successful at every level.
I do believe that that's at the heart of a functioning democracy. I gave a talk, I frequently, in most of the talks I give about smarter government, I give, you know, outside of my own state. I was invited to come to Nigeria for 36 elected, re-elected or newly elected governors of Nigeria. And fortunately, their English was much better than my ability to speak one of the 200 languages spoken in Nigeria. So I went through those excuses.
Oh, they're universal.
They're universal. All of those Nigerian governors looked at each other and started laughing. Oh. They had all heard it. Vice President Gore started bringing groups up from Washington and the State Department to see state stat when we started. Sometimes they'd come with headphones and a translator, and I could measure with 7 seconds after I said it in English, the translation would come through and they'd all look at each other.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we've heard that.
I mean, so I get
China, too. I was at a University of Maryland thing over in China as part of that trade mission, and all of those Chinese public administrators, same. It's human nature.
I got something I want to go back to with you, because
if you believe, one final thing,
sure,
Don's County Executive, if you believe you can't, you just talked about culture, if you believe you can or you believe you can't, you're probably right.
You're going to get it.
Absolutely.
Exactly.
You mentioned something in the second segment. I wrote it down because you said something about raising money in elections, and Don speaks that language from 20 years of doing that. You speak that. How much did they raise? The mayor's money came out this week in raising money. I believe this is the root of all evil. You know, when it really drills down, the more I know about it, the sleazier it is. You know, as we watch this gross leader of our country, leader in quotes, get impeached and lie and continue to lie. The money in elections and where it comes from. I see the names, the same.
The money in office.
Yeah.
I mean, do we look the other way now when chief executive officers like our own governor make themselves millionaires while in office?
Why has that?
What's happened to our ethics?
Why has that story? And again, we invite, and Nestor's reached out again two or three times this week. We want the governor to come on. We certainly will be polite. We'll have a good spirited discussion. But why has the story that came out a week or two ago about the governor profiting on land deals and decisions that he's making, particularly with the Department of Transportation and Infrastructure, why is that? You know, have we gotten so jaded that we don't pay attention to that stuff? I mean, that's a pretty big story to me, Governor.
Yeah, you would think. I think there's a great danger in our having become jaded or numb to these sorts of ethical abuses. I mean, I couldn't ever imagine Paris Glendening being able to get away with putting his brother in charge of the family real estate development company and then punching in interchanges into a budget where that directly, proximately, and possibly affects those development.
Or the O'Malley brothers buying some property and then saying, we're gonna change some priorities here in the city.
We got a president selling drinks to the Arabs down the street at a hotel.
Well,
bar.
And that's the problem. Yeah. And the answer that you sometimes hear when this comes up in conversation is, well, it's not as bad as Trump. Well, is that the new bar?
Is that the standard?
Is that the new standard?
I hope not.
Is that the new standard?
Well, we're going to find out in a couple weeks.
Well, speaking of Trump, I can't.
Hopefully the legislature will do something on this. I never thought I'd find myself. You remember Tony O'Donnell from Calder County? Tony O'Donnell was minority leader of the party of Lincoln when I was governor. Every week, Tony would file FOIA requests for any guests that came to the governor's mansion or
who went to the
Ravens. Every week, Tony would be demanding.
Marty, take a free crab cake.
Right. Demanding that I prove that I didn't take a free bet.
Right.
But hey, you know what? I didn't take it personally. Right. And in a way, I was kind of, I had a great deal of respect for Tony because I knew, I said, you know, I might not be doing these things, bad things, but I'm glad that our tradition is such that whatever party's the minority party, they see it as their job
checks
to make sure, checks and balance, that the other person isn't, you know, abusing their executive authority. So never thought I'd say, what would Tony O'Donnell do?
Right.
But I hope the members of the Maryland General Assembly, especially our newly elected presiding officers, reflect upon what sort of legacy they want to create. Should it be the rule for all time moving forward that governors of Maryland get to make millions of dollars by their public decisions without a single recusal and without ever disclosing the parcel locations of that he and his family own or their clients, or the source of income. And to add, you know, Trump-like chutzpah to all of this, our current governor refuses to release what he earned before he became governor from the real estate company that once had to declare bankruptcy, compared to the multi-millions he's making now that he has the power of the governor's office to say, the interchange goes here. That client gets affordable housing tax credits. That person gets their wetlands waiver. That developer gets their state highway access permit. That's where we're going to put another interchange because it makes my properties more lucrative. That's how we're going to draw the enterprise or the opportunity zones near my properties. It's really appalling. People around the country laugh at us on this.
Well, it's all in the public record. And I
should
would suggest,
be.
I mean, some folks that are listening to us now, Nestor knows, will get some hate mail. You're familiar with that. They're going to say we're attacking the Republican governor. But what we would say is that this is a nonpartisan issue. I would suggest you hold Democrats, Republicans, Independents to that same standard. Speaking of that, and again, we are going to have all the congressional candidates on today, so we are a little bit under the gun. We're going to have to run here shortly. But Nestor is so passionate, he calls them his people. People that look like him were thrown in cages. I mean, a terrible, terrible stain on our country recently.
I'm Venezuelan. My father's an immigrant.
With
you know
the detention.
And
you had a little... Oh, we've been joined by the longtime owner of Haley, Bill Devine. A legend.
Good. Come around and get in.
Come on,
camera.
Bill. Come on around and say hi.
We're wrapping things up.
Come on, Bill. Say hi to the governor.
This is the new market.
Oh there
you
go.
Market.
We got new market plans. Look at that.
Taking my copy.
Look at that.
Oh, okay. There you go. Good man.
When you come down here to Fadley's, check it. Ask for Bill. He'll say hi to you.
New market, altogether new.
That's awesome.
Well, this is beautiful. BCT Architects.
Bill, thank you so much for hanging in here.
We're going to be right on this upper corner, right there.
That's great.
Bill, how many years you been here?
I've been here 61.
61 years. You should come around and get in the camera.
Come on, Bill. Come on around.
Come around here. They sell muskrat here. I don't know if you know that.
They threw a muskrat on Nestor's seat
one
day.
Here, Bill.
Hi, folks. Hey, Bill, tell the folks.
How young you are.
That's the camera.
I'm 88.
Yeah. No.
Just 88.
Yep. Just 88?
Yep.
Bill, you're my hero.
Tell the folks. give us a real quick for dummies. Nestor showed it. Talk us about the new Fadley's and the new market.
Well, the market, they were going to tear this one down or renovate it. And I stood up at a meeting and said, that's asinine. You're going to kick us out for 2 years. That's dumb. I had a dream the other night. I dreamt that being that this is not a historic building, it's a historic site, that you built a new market on the south parking lot. We stayed open for the 2 years. Then we moved in, and then you either repurposed this building or tore it down. They said, why didn't we think of that?
Good man.
Show me my house.
Show me my house.
Show me my house. Governor had a thing in the book. The governor talks about that.
This is my book. You didn't. You knew I was your mayor and your governor. You didn't know I could write, did you? You didn't know I could read and write.
But the governor says that what people want to know, and you just exhibited it at that community meeting, show me my house. Tell me what that means.
Yeah, well, when we would have meetings when I was first elected mayor, Bill, we would bring community leaders from different parts of the city and in a certain rotation and show them what we were doing to deliver better services as a city. You know, all the stuff we take for granted, 311 for all city services, the map. And it didn't matter whether the group of citizens were from North Baltimore, South Baltimore, black, white, rich, poor. Somebody would always raise their hand about 5 minutes into my slideshow and say, can you show me my house?
Yeah.
It's that essential ground truth thing of democracy and government and democratic decision makings, like the one you said, which was, I had this dream. Why can't you guys do this like this?
I don't want to be out of business for 2 years.
So thank you for not giving up. I'm sure it wasn't I'm sure the epiphany didn't come as a dream to them when you suggested it, because a lot of times government is moving in one direction and you really have to be persistent in order to get people in charge to wake up. So thanks for hanging in. This is going to be beautiful.
It's a pleasure, and the family will carry it on. and it'll be good.
You're here another time.
Bill still believes in Fahey. Thank you, Bill, very much for stopping by.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you, Bill.
Thank you.
You
got it. Governor, I can't.
Not a renovation which connotes impediment, but a new structure.
A new structure.
New structure. There we go. Governor,
new structure.
Can't let you get out of here. I was talking about Nestor and immigration, and you fought in the state for tuition to really dignify immigrants.
Yeah, that was a good campaign.
It was a great campaign.
And the people of Baltimore and people in Maryland
came through.
They voted
just
for
like
it.
They did.
Fair
on,
is fair. If your family pays
and others.
If your family pays state taxes and your kid can get into a state school, you pay state tuition.
But as I told you shortly after we ran into each other over the holidays, and I said you were actually quite popular at the Mower Thanksgiving because it was Thanksgiving morning when a little tete-a-tete hit the paper about one of your former classmates at Gonzaga down at the Dubliner. And you and he had words, and he didn't like it. How do you? What do you say about that?
You know, this is the first time on camera I've been asked about this. I went to Gonzaga down in the District of Columbia, and every year they have a Gonzaga smoker. So all of us from all classes gather, and as the class of 81 has gotten older, we have taken to gathering at the Dubliner in that quiet, more quiet back bar area, which they now call the President's Bar because Barack Obama, while he was president, once surprised everybody by showing up there one St. Patrick's Day. So into that bar walked a man who graduated 5 years after me named Ken Cuccinelli, who is currently the person in charge of executing President Trump's policies, which he seems to do with relish, especially when it comes to putting brown-skinned Spanish-speaking people inside of internment camps and ripping toddlers from the arms of their parents, something I never thought I'd say about any American doing intentionally.
It's despicable.
In my lifetime. So, you know the art of Irish diplomacy, Nestor? The art of Irish diplomacy is the ability to tell a man to go to hell and have him look forward to the trip. And so I let Mr. Cuccinelli know, under no uncertain terms, and sometimes with theological sites.
And on my behalf, thank you very much.
on behalf of my ancestors and my grandchildren as yet unborn, that he was not welcome here. And
you referenced, again, and I go back to that Washington Post quote. That's where I tie. That's why I go back to the beginning, where they said, it's a guy that prays every day, a go to church every Sunday guy. You reference, if it's accurate, who knows if the stuff that we read was accurate. But you reference it, it's not what the Jesuits taught us.
Yeah, really.
I mean,
well, that's the irony of this. I mean, we both went to the same Jesuit high school. Jesuits have this mantle, as anybody in the Baltimore area knows, who might have gone to Loyola. Men for others.
We're raising men,
increasingly, you know, co-ed. We're people to be mindful of the needs and the power we each have to be of positive, life-giving, and loving service to other human beings. So the notion that this guy could have gone through the same high school would show up in an Irish bar of all places, thinking that everybody's going
to
give them high fives and say, "Hey, how's work? Oh, it's great.
We're locking kids up.
Yeah, we're locking kids up and we're putting them in cages and having them roll around in their own feces and traumatizing them for the rest of their life. Work's good." So the danger of this time in our country's history, I think, is us becoming a passive culture of our acting like these sorts of crimes being against humanity that are being committed on our behalf and in the name of our government. It's just the new norm. It's another channel on the cable flicker, and it's not. And none of us should feel compelled to go silent and become polite when in the presence of people that think the Statue of Liberty should have its motto changed, or that ripping toddlers from their mom's arms is acceptable behavior by our government. It's not.
I want to bring you to Iowa, and we'll wrap with this because we're 4 years out.
Where are we going? We're going to Iowa?
Iowa.
I've been there many times.
He's been there. He knows a little bit about traipsing through
Iowa. And a little bit in the 1980s with Perry Hart as well. For you, with 4 years ago, you had this dream right now that you were going to be the guy catching fire. I watched you on the platforms. I watched all the debates with you and Bernie.
I don't know. So there was so much as a dream as a mission.
Okay, but 4 years ago.
Not every mission's a dream.
Understood, but knowing that those kids might not have been in cages. Well, certainly would have been in cages had you been running the place. And where we are right now, where you've been, and where we're going with the next 8 or 9 months. We talk so much about the city, and I'm passionate about the city, but I woke up this morning really pissed off. I mean, we should be doing AFC Championship game, I guess, bringing it back to the beginning here, and instead we're talking about this. Lies. We're talking about Ukrainians. We're talking about Lev Parnas. That's where we are right now.
Yeah, and the impeachment. It's a solemn. I made my son, my 17-year-old, sit down and watch it. I said, "You all talk about this much at high school?" He said, "No, not too much. We're busy." I said, "Well, you're going to sit down and watch what's happening right now, because it's a really big deal for our republic. Whether on the other side of this, we are still a nation of laws where no one is above the law, or whether we become something different." Something where, something that where our leaders can somehow, commit crimes and there's no accountability for it. So when I ran for president, it was because I had you never know anything in politics, Don, but I had a gut feeling that Hillary was headed to defeat in the fall, and I had to try.
I told Nestor the other day, you had that part of the equation correct.
Yeah, notwithstanding the fact that I knew that even my own Marylanders would say to me privately on the phone, "Martin, I fear you might be right, but how are you going to keep her from getting the nomination when Barack Obama and the Clinton machine are both together on this?" That was actually said to me by a statewide Democratic official. You might be right, but so I had to try. I'm also very glad that we spoke fearlessly, truthfully about issues of immigration, and also about climate, and also about gun safety.
Well, you warned people what the other side would look like. Now that we've seen that, holy hell!
Yeah, and I didn't think that Donald Trump was so funny coming up. No. I saw that as the threat. And so, look, elections are an opportunity to great countries sometimes make really bad mistakes. Good people correct them quickly. We've seen a bit of a course correction when it came to the midterms.
Sure.
And
that's why we're impeached now to begin
with,
right?
Wouldn't be this accountability happening and the check and balance being restored without the people having voted that way. And I do believe that we have an opportunity. But we need to talk. We need a candidate to rise who will actually talk about that fearless American future that we want for our kids, not where we build walls and cower about what tomorrow might look like, but instead where we face the future together. We're heading into a third industrial revolution, a mixing of new technologies faster than we've ever seen in transportation and energy, namely renewable energy, and in communications, the Internet of Things. When that happens, there's a lot of unpredictability, a lot of change, and a lot of fear, because people see that the job they had in the last industrial revolution isn't going to be around in the next. But we didn't win the first and second industrial revolutions by building walls or putting our heads in the sand or doing something else with our heads. No, we faced the future. We invested in our kids' skills, our people's skills. We had a strong country at our back, and together as Americans, we brought forward better opportunities for our kids. And we can do that now. In fact, I would argue that it's easier for us where we are right now because of past generations to win this next industrial revolution than it was for our great grandparents or our parents to win the last two.
Can we have you back on?
Yeah.
We'd love to have you back. Nestor, smarter.
I'm going to hold him longer next time.
Smarter government.
Let him eat his
go out there to your bookstore, to Amazon. Terrific book. As I said, I don't care whether you're a Democrat, Republican, Independent. This is a great book. It will make you think about government. It's been our pleasure to have Governor and Mayor Martin O'Malley. Nestor, where are we?
We are at Fainley's, and he's going to finally have his... We're going to heat that thing.
Finally eat his crab cake.
Get his crab cake back. Grab the book. Grab us. Baltimore Positive. Lots and lots of stuff with candidates from the 7th Congressional District coming your way next on Baltimore Positive, as well as Bobby Zirkin and our Maryland Hospital Association dealio in Annapolis. I'm Nestor. He's Don. That's the governor. They call him the mayor here. We are Baltimore Positive and WNST.net signing off.